Hello, Jeroen.
Hello, Dylan.
And what are we talking about today?
Today, we're talking about building trustworthy tools, which is something that we really enjoy, both you and me, I'm sure.
That is true. I'd say we enjoy building and using trustworthy tools.
Oh, yeah. using them even more. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What a coincidence that Elm fans would enjoy trustworthy tools. Who would have thought?
Yeah. Well, you say that, but a lot of other communities don't enjoy them as much as we do. Or yes. At least they don't seem to put as much of an emphasis on them.
Right. It's an interesting question. Like, I mean, what is it that they're seeking something besides trustworthiness? Like maybe convenience or...
performance.
Rich ecosystem performance. Or is it that they have a different set of criteria for what they consider to be trustworthy in a different ecosystem? I wonder. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's more about like they value reliability, and which is trust in a sense. Mm-hmm. But they don't know what they could have. Mm-hmm. So if they don't know what is possible, then they don't ask for it. They don't request it from their tools.
Right, right. If you have, I mean, maybe somebody who's working with TypeScript, they get IntelliSense that shows them the thing they were looking for and catches some bugs that mm-hmm. something was null that they didn't check for. And they're like, wow, that's a reliable tool.
So that's okay, great. That's absolutely great.
And I wonder, is there a continuum of trade-offs between trustworthiness and sort of hand-holding or, you know, I think that that's how a lot of people would look at it. But as Elm developers, I think we would tend to say like, yes, we do have strong guarantees in Elm. But we don't feel like we're fighting against the compiler. We feel like the compiler is pushing us along and the things that it's preventing us from doing are things that we're glad we weren't able to do. It's not like, oh, if only the compiler would let me do this thing.
Yeah. When you say handholding, do you mean like if you're trying to cross the street while holding the hand of your parents and then they stop you
right.
because there's a car? You mean like people don't like that?
You know, it's ironic. In America, there are a lot of, you know, you'll have like if there's a big drop off, like an old historic building or something where there's like a big cliff suddenly.
Oh, yeah.
You're like mm-hmm. walking out to see a historic site and there's a big cliff. So people go and explore. And in America, there will be often like a big fence preventing you from going off the cliff. It's like, mm-hmm. this is an impossible state going off the cliff. We will make it impossible. We'll put a fence there. And a lot of like your European historical sites, you're just like, whoa, there's just a cliff there. Like someone could just walk off the cliff, but it's a different approach of, so I guess there's like, is there a balance between making the tool trustworthy and trusting the user? You know, is that a dimension?
I think there is. I mean, the annoying part with handholding is when you get yanked back mm-hmm. On the side sidewalk. And I feel like something that Elm does quite well, for instance, the compiler, is when it yanks you back, it does it in a gentle way. So it pulls you back slightly in a nice, gentle way. Whereas a C++ compiler, from my experience back 15 years ago, is like, bam! Yank you and throw you on the curb and you figure out for yourself what you did wrong or something.
Right. That's a good distinction.
Yeah, whereas the compiler tells you, hey, this was dangerous because there was a car coming there. It was driving at this speed and if you walked forward, then it would have hit you, which would have been bad because we're in the US and the bill would have been huge or right. something like that.
Someone would have gotten sued. Yeah.
So, yeah. I feel like maybe the problem with handholding is not so much that the handholding is the communication around it. Like if you explain the problems correctly, if you explain the reasoning behind it, then things are nicer. So for instance, if I want to walk across the street, I need to make sure that the there's no car in sight or that it's sufficiently far away. And if that's not the case, then I should be blocked if I want to stay alive, right?
Yeah, and to a certain extent, it comes down to you're going to trust your tool more if it's preventing you from doing things that you're actually, you know, once you figure it out, you say, oh, maybe you see a compiler error and you're like, what? No, this is fine. This should work. What's wrong? Mm-hmm. And then you sort through it and you're like, oh, I see. Yeah, I did need to handle a case, or I did need to get these types to line up. So a tool can earn your trust by not giving you false alarms and not preventing you from doing things that would be reasonable to do.
Yeah, the tool should definitely not give you false alarms. And when it gives you an alarm, a real one, there are three pieces of information that it should give you. It should give you, indicate you what the problem is, what you did wrong, what you almost did wrong, why it is a problem, like what is the reasoning behind the issue. So I pulled you back from the road because otherwise you would have been hit. And if you don't give that information, then people will think that it's you got stopped for a stupid reason. Like people are going to get frustrated. Like, this tool doesn't want me to do this, blah, blah, blah. And then they're going to be frustrated. They're going to complain. So I think explaining the reason behind a problem, behind an error, is very valuable. And then you need to, the third piece of information is like, how can you go forward? How can you unblock yourself? Like, when is it okay to cross a road? Once you've seen, looked at once you've taken a look at the road and seen that there's no car around, then you can walk, but not in the other cases. So like, yeah, when you have a Elm compiler error, you want to know what the problem is. Like, oh, why is it wrong that my, what did I write wrong here? And the compiler will tell you, well, you had an if branch, an if expression, and in the first branch you had a type number, and the second branch you had a type string, and that's wrong. And then why is it a problem? Well, for Elm to make sure that you have something that is working, it requires you to have the same type in both branches. And then it could go on, like, explain why that is necessary for it, potentially. And then you need to explain how to move forward. Like, how can I solve this problem? Do I need to convert one of these to an integer, for instance? And I actually have an example for that, this exact example. And Elm gives you all these information and more, which is really useful. So if you just read the error message in full, you know all this information, you don't get frustrated, and you know how to unblock yourself.
Yeah, it makes me think, like, if somebody's crossing the street and you yell, stop, that's actually kind of hard to trust because you haven't given clear information why. But if somebody's starting to cross the street and you say, car, now you've actually just as concisely given information with some not only like reason why it's important, but more actionable information. Because if you say stop, are you calling out stop because you're getting a phone call and you need to wait in that area, and it would be fine for them to like cross the street and sit on a bench and stop for you there? Or so it doesn't, saying stop doesn't help you in an actionable way where you know in what way to stop. Like, should I stop? I'm in the middle of the road. Should I stop in the middle of the road? But if you say car, then, oh, I should probably remove myself from the road, check my surroundings, and see which direction the car is coming from. So in the same way, if an error message just says something went wrong, it can be very frustrating for the user, and it doesn't earn their trust that they should listen to us. It's almost just unfairly demanding their attention without giving them an actionable way to deal with that information, and without it's not nice to tell somebody, pay attention, do this thing, without giving them the motivation behind it. I think it's a kinder thing to do to users or other human beings in general to bring them into that process and tell them why. It's important to share why.
Yeah. It's kind of the same thing on the news and politics, like saying this policy is a terrible idea.
Mm.
well, that's
right.
Great news. I'm not sure I'm going to trust you. But this policy is a bad idea because, and then your argument is that's a lot more helpful. Or it can also be helpful to know why the person thinks that it's a bad policy, and then you can counter arguments.
Yes.
Counter argue that.
Right. The compiler says, this says it's a maybe string, but you need a string. You're like, compiler, can we talk for a minute? Because I disagree. Just reason with it.
I just have a string.
So this has come up for me in Elm Pages when I've been working on the user experience for the dev server.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I noticed, I was trying to pay attention to like how it felt interacting with the dev server when I build things with it. And one of the things that I noticed was if I'm on a 404 page in the dev server, you know, and Elm Pages has a file-based router. So if it just says 404, page not found in the dev server, then I'm saying, but why is it 404? Why can't you find it?
So you're trying to go to a page and for some reason it couldn't find it.
Yep. The dev server says.
Even though you were actually trying to work on that page. So you were kind of expecting to find that page, right?
I was expecting to find that page. Yep. And now what I found was what that made me want to do is restart the dev server, hard refresh the browser. In other words, not trust the tool. It made me not trust the dev server. So
yeah.
I found that even when I earned the trust by having the 404 pages only be shown when as an accurate reflection of reality, that the routes were reloaded accurately whenever they needed to be, and it was always showing accurate information. If I didn't present the user with more context, then they still wouldn't trust it. And me as a proxy for the user, I experienced that. So
yeah, you doubt the tool just in case. Yeah.
Yep.
Because it could potentially solve the issue.
Right. So you need more context. So what I did is I mean, in hindsight, it sounds very simple, but I don't actually know of other dev servers that do this. But so what I changed it to is it will say, either I didn't find a route matching the URL you're on. Here are the routes that I have. And it lists out all the different routes. So if you go and you create a new route module that's going to add a new route to your project, you will see it live reload with a new route showing up. And then there's another scenario in Elm Pages where you can have like a set of statically rendered pages, and it might not be one of them. So you could have like /posts/slug, but the particular slug you're rendering is not. So in that case, I show a different error message. I say, hey, I matched this route. This route exists, but this slug is not one of the slugs that you told me to render. So I don't know how to handle that.
Gotcha.
And then it will say, these are the slugs that I do know how to render. And so the user might be able to go there and say, oh, I see the typo that I made, or I expected to add a route like this, and I expected it to be handled this way. But it gives them feedback so they can kind of fine tune what went wrong.
Yeah, it's all the information that you kind of wish you had, but you often don't.
Mm-hmm.
The scary part is when the tool, you don't trust it and you rerun it, and then it actually works. Like that's...
Yeah, exactly. That's
where you don't want to end up. Because then people will think, oh yeah, this tool, sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't reload correctly. So sometimes you need to exit it and restart it again. And if you hit that point, then people are just going to do that sometimes just in case. Oh, just rerun your ID. Oh, just rerun your, reboot your computer.
Exactly.
I mean, and that's a huge time waste. Like we've seen it with rebooting your computer. Like, if it doesn't work, it sucks so much. And if it works, you know it's going to suck for the next time that you're going to encounter this problem.
Yes. And when users become superstitious like that with their tools and warranted superstition, right? It's well-founded superstition, because when they do magic incantations, it does solve the problem sometimes. But when you build that kind of relationship with users, then think about the cognitive load that's going on. So the problem solving capacity that could be put towards debugging their specific problem is now spent on debugging the tool and whether it's doing the thing it's supposed to be doing, which is a very bad state of things. And if you compound that with a large number of tools that the user doesn't trust, now think of all the different permutations of incompatible, untrustworthy states that these tools could get into. Now suddenly the user is or the developer, whoever's using the tool, is spending a huge amount of their brain capacity to just think through these possible scenarios and how to do the magic incantations to fix them.
Yeah. I know that I personally feel like I'm very bad at doing anything related to infrastructure or computer infrastructure. So for instance, like using Docker, setting up an architecture where you have Redis, you have MongoDB or whatever, and all those things. I really have a hard time. And I feel like it's because there's a lot of information that I wish was there and potentially explanations because I never got good at it. And these are really hard to find to me. Like, for instance, with Docker, I think you can talk to things that are executed inside of Docker through ports. And then you have to open that port on Docker side, which has one number. And then you have a port on the outgoing side, something like that. And which ones are open is not available information to me. At least I don't know how to do to get it. But basically, that's all those pieces of information that I wish I had. And if I don't, I'm going to try everything until I just quit or succeed.
Right.
Hopefully succeed.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with installing things. Like I feel like I have very bad luck with installing things. install Node.js. Okay. Da-da-da. Oh, well, now it doesn't work when I run this program. Oh. And there's a reason behind it. Like, there's a reason why it doesn't work, but I don't have it. So I'm going to try everything. I'm going to try and reboot my computer multiple times.
Yeah.
And at some point, hopefully it works. But
you hope your snowflake doesn't melt, because it's going to be hard to create a new one from scratch.
What is that?
Well, you don't know the snowflake term? Like, people talk about snowflakes in terms of like reproducible environments. Like, every snowflake is unique, right? It's like a fingerprint. Like, no two snowflakes are alike. So
okay,
yeah, snowflake is the term for a non-reproducible environment. Yeah, I'm not sure if snowflakes melting is a thing, but I think it should be.
I mean, it turns to water.
Then it's more uniform. Yeah, true.
But if you mean an environment, then I don't know. Yeah, I do feel like my environments sometimes are like a smudge of everything. So maybe a mud snowflake ish. Yeah, so as you said, like, you actually, if you want to make a tool that you can trust, then you actually need to make sure that it does the right thing as expected. Like, it needs to do the job that it advertises. So if you have a watch mode or live dev server running, then it actually needs to reload everything as it should, which can be really hard, like, especially with watching files on your system that has plenty of tricky issues. But then, yeah, you also need to communicate a lot of useful information that that the tool has available that the user might want to have, or at least to instill trust in the relationship.
Right. I'm realizing that a lot of this, I think, comes down to making the tool predictable for the user. And so, like, giving the user context is one way to make things more predictable. You know, making it do the same thing, whether you create a new route this one way or change this thing this other place or delete a route module, or, you know, however you arrive at a particular state of things, having it behave the same way is another thing that makes it more predictable. Another thing that makes tools more predictable is having like a clear, understandable mental model.
Yeah.
If it has a lot of magic in the mental model, or if it has like leaky abstractions or inconsistencies in the mental model, it's less predictable for the user.
Well, using this function is not enough. You also need to have called this function previously, and otherwise it won't work. And like, I wish it was written in documentation or in the error message.
Never call this function after you've done this thing. I saw a tweet recently that I thought was very interesting. It's actually longer than a tweet because it's a tweet of an image with text. But if you don't mind humoring me to read something a bit longer than a tweet. So we'll link to this, but it says layering platforms properly. One of the most important goals of a rationalized platform, I hadn't heard that term, is that it is well layered in multiple senses. One type of layering is ensuring that higher layers are more opinionated than lower layers. So I thought that was interesting. Another important layering property is that as much as possible, higher layers should be explainable in terms of lower layers. So in a sense, it's talking about like almost like composable mental models where your mental model at one level builds on top of your mental model at another level. So it says that is the higher level API should express semantics that are a reasonably thin or opinionated combining of semantics exposed by lower layers that are strictly lower in the stack.
Yeah. I'm thinking, is it finished?
The last part says layers that do not follow this property are likely either too thick or rely on too much magic. That's a layering smell that implies that there are things that developers might want to do that they won't be able to break apart and use separately, i.e. the platform is not composed of bricks held together loosely. It also makes the layer harder to reason about. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah. The first thing that I'm thinking about is programming languages where you have a bytecode assembly at the bottom, a binary even lower, and you have C++ and Rust and those compiling to WebAssembly, to assembly, not as WebAssembly. Yeah. And then you have languages like JavaScript that kind of compile to that.
Yeah, although they break a lot of mental models about performance characteristics like we talked with Robin about.
Yes, like there's some magic and there's some things that are really hard to explain, at least with my understanding of the engine, of how it works. And then you've got languages like Elm, which can be explained through JavaScript. Oh, well, this function simply compiles to this JavaScript function, which usually doesn't rely on too much magic. So I feel like that tweet is pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. And like Elm Review, for example, it's actually just an Elm project. So that's actually pretty cool, right? Because it means that you can, anything you can use to reason about an Elm project, there's an elm.json. You install dependencies with Elm install. You can open it up in your editor. And, you know, all of your assumptions about an Elm project apply to an Elm review folder. The review folder is
just an Elm project.
Just an Elm project.
You can run Elm make on it.
Right.
And other Elm tooling. Yeah. There is a Node.js part, but let's skip that part.
Right. But see, that is a strong opinion that is easily explainable in terms of the lower layers. So that would, I think, follow this tweet's advice about how to layer platforms. Because you could have like an elmreview.json and it's a set of the rules that you install. And if you put a particular special JSON key in there, it's going to automatically install those rules and there's JSON config for those rules. And right. So like, there are all sorts of ways that Elm Review could be designed where it doesn't build off of that mental model that Elm developers already have.
Yeah. And there was some exploration of how to do that for quite a while. Like, I could have like review dependencies in the Elm JSON file. Which was what I was going for at the beginning, and then turned out that the Elm compiler just removes them when you install another dependency. So like, well, I guess that doesn't work as well as expected.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like the end result. It's not really nice to say, well, it's this whole new application, but it has some very nice properties. So I'm happy with it.
I think it worked out very well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So another thing that comes up in trustworthy tools is that I think Elm developers are particularly tuned into is invalid configurations or invalid ways to use a package. And in general, I really like this idea of eliminating caveats. Just like if I find myself explaining something, hey, here's this new design. Uh-huh. Here's this new package. Oh, cool. How do you use it? Well, you do this, but there's one thing I should explain. It's like, okay, hold on. Capture that. What was that caveat? Can you design it so that it doesn't require that caveat? And just keep massaging the caveats out of the design.
Yeah. I mean, you do need to explain like the mental model that you might need right. to have. You might need to explain the yes. bigger picture. But yeah, like, oh, by the way, you should never use this function. Otherwise, everything's going to break. Like, can we remove that function? Well, no, because, are you sure?
I like that distinction because like, if it feels like you're explaining a mental model, then it's a consistent mental model. If you're explaining a caveat, why do we not call that a mental model? I mean, technically it is, but it's a caveat within the mental model. It's an inconsistency in that mental model. So I think that is the distinction, but like you definitely do need to, you know, when you're building packages, APIs, tools, whether it's internal within a company or an external tool, you are going to need to learn some mental model, and that's okay. But
absolutely. Yeah.
Is it going to be a predictable mental model and a consistent mental model? And if you know, noticing those asterisks is a really good way to look for inconsistencies in the mental model.
Do you have an example of a caveat like in Elm, in the Elm language or Elm tooling?
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this design change where in Elm GraphQL, actually when it went from being called GraphQL to Elm GraphQL, when I found a way to turn a fragment and selection set into the same concept, and a selection set with zero items, one item, more than one item in it, it's just the same concept. That was a caveat. That was like, how do you... That was an inconsistency in the mental model, that you couldn't think of those things in the same way. And so I massaged that out. And it took work in the internal implementation detail. It doesn't come for free to massage out the caveats. You have to do it through careful design. But when you do, the user can think about it with a less complex mental model that's more predictable.
Now it comes for free for the user.
Right. Yep. But yeah, I mean, in general, I think we're keenly aware of caveats in Elm design, right? And in a way, Elm makes us be so explicit about types in our APIs and how many arguments does it take that it makes them glaringly obvious. And also just Elm developers think so much about making impossible states impossible and parse don't validate and things like that, that it sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. And oh no, now this function needs to return a maybe.
Right.
Because exactly. It might fail. Like, oh, how can we prevent this to make this nicer? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm thinking about the example of restarting Elm pages. Imagine you had to run the Elm compiler like two or three times before you can be quite certain that it works, that there's no right. error. Or
yes.
That would suck. Or you have to remove Elm stuff.
Right.
Or clear your Elm home, or that would be such a waste of time.
It puts quite a burden on the user to need to think about those things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's all the things that you don't have to think about
mm-hmm.
anymore. Like, I've been thinking about linters for quite a while, as you might know. And for instance, my love-hate relationship with disable comments.
Yes, I do.
Mostly a hate relationship, but
yeah.
So I know that people find that term confusing. So the disable comments are those comments that you add to your code to disable linter warnings. So
it's almost like a caveat.
It is almost like a caveat, like
a little asterisk in your code that says this rule is enforced everywhere except for these few places.
Except in this case, yeah. So you have a like ESLint disable comment. I'm just giving the example of ESLint because that's one I'm most familiar with.
And you've contributed to the ecosystem quite a bit, so...
Yeah. I could have given the example of Elm Review disable comments, but those don't exist.
except for known tail recursion.
In a way, yeah. Those are more hints to the rule, but yeah.
There's a caveat to Elm Review's lack of the caveat of a disabled comment.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying that it's, what I made
it's
is
a
perfect.
Reasonable one. It's a good trade-off. It's a good trade-off.
So far,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing I've been noticing is that, like, when you... So linters are actually one of the tools that are the least trustworthy among the software tooling that is available. They actually have a very bad reputation of just reporting way too many false positives. And false positives are annoying because they block you. You need to solve them if you want to go forward. And if you go back to the three points of information that I gave before, like how to, what is the problem, what is the reasoning behind it, and how to unblock myself. A lot of times those pieces of information are not given. Main reason for that is that these tools usually give you a one line error message.
Mm-hmm.
Which is right. Like that's not a lot of information for me to go on. And that can be very frustrating. So when you don't have all the information, then you will often think about, well, how can I unblock myself? And the easiest way for that is to use a disable comment. So if you really don't know what to do, then you're going to reach for that. That's almost a certainty. You can ask maybe a coworker, but otherwise you're going to reach for that. And that's going to be made even worse if you're used to having false positives, because then, oh, well, this case is very likely to be a false positive again. I'm just going to ignore it. So you add a disable comment and you don't think about it anymore.
So for example, if you have like an ESLint rule for unused functions, but then you yes. have a disable comment for one function that you're like, well, yeah, but I'm going to use this, or it breaks the mental model of we don't have unused functions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an exception.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, if you have that option of using the disable comment, you're going to ask yourself, should I use a disable comment here? Like every right. time you see an error, like, should I use it? Can I use it? Is it okay to use it?
Hmm.
Those are questions that you don't see in Elm Review when you use Elm Review, because you don't have that option. You don't think about those unless you know that it's wrong mm-hmm. for some reason, and then please open an issue. But the usual exception for that is like people want to keep that their code around because they haven't finished a feature or something, but there are better options, in my opinion, than disable comments. So yeah, like... And there's another, what did you call it, nudge or incentive, if you have those disabled comments, is that, well, I'm going to write a rule, and if it turns out to be wrong or impractical to apply the advice, then people can just add a disabled comment, meaning that as a rule author, you're more inclined to writing bad rules,
mm-hmm.
which is not the case in Elm Review, because you can't disable things willy-nilly. So therefore, the quality has to be higher. And in some cases, it needs to be too high for the rule to even exist, which might be a bad trade-off in some cases. I wish we could have more of those, but I haven't found a good way to make the tool trustworthy and still have being able to detect things like code smells. But yes, something that I've noticed is that the tool needs to communicate well. And it needs to not give you all those easy escape hatches for mm-hmm. you to reach out for. Otherwise, people are just going to use them. And yeah, the result is not that great.
Yeah.
The result is sometimes like you enable a rule, you're going to think, okay, well, this critical problem will never appear anymore because we now have a review rule to make sure it doesn't happen again. And then someone adds a disable comment and like, well, now I can't trust that guarantee is true. Potentially someone disabled it. So you need to go and check whether someone added a disabled comment somewhere, which is like just like restarting your tool again. Like, oh, well, I think it's right, but I'm just going to check again just to mm-hmm. be sure.
Right.
So you want a tool for your tool.
Right. Exactly.
And people are going to add escape hatches to that one. And then you need a tool for a tool for a tool for a tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, an escape hatch, I mean, obviously, we're fans of eliminating escape hatches in the Elm community. And some people find that frustrating, but mm-hmm. some, you know, it's also a big part of what we love about Elm. But I wonder, is an escape hatch a type of caveat that breaks the mental model? It's just like another case of a caveat, you know?
Depends on your definition of it breaks your mental model. It's just like there's an exception to your mental model that's made possible because of the escape hatch.
Right.
Just like, just like saying this is it's sphere and it's perfectly round. And then you actually mm-hmm. have an escape hatch on there, meaning at that exact location, it is not round.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So it's a almost round balloon.
Yeah. I mean, it's more, well, I guess it's two things. It's like, number one, if there's an escape hatch, then there's something that could have been more consistent in the mental model, possibly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes careful design, of course, and that's easier said than done. But secondly, like it might be layering things like this tweet talked about in terms that aren't like a cohesive layer that you can think of as like an opinionated layer, and it's sort of leaking between two different layers of abstraction.
So how would you prevent a layer from doing too much magic, for instance? How do you prevent one from being explained by what is underneath it?
Right. Well, so like, for example, you know, I've been working on a new form API for the Elm Pages v3 release I'm working on. And you know, I've been heavily inspired, as we've talked about, by Remix's approach, which is kind of trying to take this concept of progressively enhancing forms, where the browser has built-in forms. We have an existing kind of low-level mental model of a primitive that the web provides, just like the web provides a primitive of links. And you go to a new page, and we have single-page apps, and they sort of hook into that mental model. So you go to a new page, it doesn't actually use the browser's page navigation, it intercepts that and progressively mm-hmm. enhances it and uses JavaScript to pull in new data and change to a new page. Well, similarly, like, what if we use progressive enhancement to take that foundational mental model of something that exists in the web, forms, a way of having key value pairs that you can send to a server, and in response to that data you send to the server can do something and then go to a new page. Well, what if we take that same mental model and build off of it? But so by doing that, you're essentially creating a set of higher level opinions on top of that idea that can take that as the foundational concept. You can do it in a way where you don't break that mental model, but you can add additional concepts to that mental model. So like, if you have a button in a form, then that button will submit. And if that button is disabled, then clicking on that button won't submit the form. And all these things that we understand in our mental model about forms, you can piggyback on that. And that reduces the learning burden of the user, because they may be familiar with forms. And if not, it's portable knowledge that they can use in different contexts, and it's not going to be contradicted by other caveats in other areas. So it's just more sort of robust, portable knowledge. And so you could take that model, build on top of it, and then progressively enhance it to actually do client-side server requests to progressively enhance the vanilla form posts. And that's sort of the basis of the Elm Pages Form API.
Yeah, so you can always explain it using what it is underneath, or by saying something is almost like whatever is underneath.
Right. It picks up where that left off. And you can actually also use the low-level thing, and it will work. You can use a vanilla form. But if you use this opinionated API that builds on top of that, it adds a couple of things to that mental model.
Yeah. But if you reason with this layer system, that does mean that a layer that comes on top of another one will necessarily be able to do less than the layer underneath it. So Elm will never be able to do anything that JavaScript isn't able to do.
True.
At least in terms of runtime.
Which is why this ethos is about having the lower level pieces being less opinionated. Yeah. It basically is saying it should get more opinionated as you go up on the stack. And we've talked about this concept in the podcast in the past about the Extensible Web Manifesto, which really influenced my thinking in Elm Pages to build with building blocks that can be composed together. And if you have an opinionated piece of a building block, you can still, you know, I mean, like, for example, Elm CSS is expressed in terms of Elm HTML. It's like a more opinionated version of that low-level building block. But having the Elm HTML package be low-level is a good basis where it has fewer opinions, which means you can build more opinionated things on top of it and not be constrained to a particular set of paths.
Elm CSS is actually built on top of Elm Virtual DOM, but...
That's true. That's true. Yeah, good point.
But very close.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, Elm Virtual DOM is based on some kind of magic, it feels like, when you don't know it. Although, yeah. That said, it's also because no one explained to me how a Virtual DOM worked, or at least in sufficient detail. Like, if you explain it, then it's probably okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's the same for anything that is reasonably complex. Like, you won't get it unless you dig in or someone explains it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, like the Extensible Web Manifesto talks about, like, if you're building a low-level platform, like, basically, the idea is that platforms should be low-level. They shouldn't be custom-tailored to specific use cases, because then you're preventing higher-level layers from being built on top of them. So, like, service workers, they shouldn't really have strong opinions about what use cases will be handled. They should have strong opinions about security and corrupted cache states and things like that, right? Those are the concerns at that level of the stack. Just like, whatever, you know, TCP, UDP are concerned about transporting data, not whether you're building, you know, a social media application or an e-commerce website. Site. It doesn't care.
I'm not going to transmit this message if it's if it's that social media website.
Well, maybe the world would be a better place. Who knows? But then we wouldn't have this tweet to talk about. So.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure that there's no IDP for Google Plus anymore. So maybe it is opinionated in a certain way.
Do you think that, I mean, I guess you've kind of touched on this, but I think about, like, having a sacred space for users. So, like, for example, you know, the obvious one that everybody is familiar with would be, like, being spammed with notifications and things like that, right? Nobody wants, you don't want the boy who cried wolf. You don't want a high amount of noise. You want a good signal to noise ratio. And
yeah,
the same is true. I mean, boy who cried wolf effect, it means you're going to start ignoring things, and it's hard to trust something if you're ignoring it. So ignoring something means you're probably not trusting it. So
are you talking about linter warnings?
Linter warnings, false alarms, error messages that aren't meaningful. And there's a balance, right? Like, I mean, in like Elm test, if you have a describe with no test cases, then mm-hmm. your test suite fails.
Yeah.
And that's a trade-off, right? It's a trade-off that it's kind of doing something that is slightly annoying because it's trying to give you feedback early. So there's a balance there, right? I mean, it's if you do too much of that, if you're stopping the world and giving a warning about every possible thing, then people can start ignoring it. So that's a delicate balance.
I know, for instance, where for Elm review rules, you can not compile your project or your rule if it doesn't have any visitors. So basically, mm-hmm. if you can detect that it will not report anything ever, then that won't compile. And people have found that to be quite annoying, because then you need to, if you want to do it like in TDD mode, then you necessarily need to write some dummy code for it to compile before you can actually start running tests and all that sorts of things. So that's something that I'm thinking of removing, because that's not all that helpful in practice. I mean, yeah, people will probably notice it if they have a rule that does nothing. There's a user experience aspect to this. Like, don't give them meaningful errors, not annoying ones. And there's also like a big case of what is a meaningful error, right? So for instance, ElmerView has a testing module that is going to check for a lot of things to make sure that your rule reports what is expected, that it does the right things, that it doesn't introduce bad automatic fixes. And I feel like those are all, they can be annoying, especially if you have written rules in other frameworks, which require a lot less checking. But there's a reason for them to be there. And I try to explain it in the error message as well, that I'm reporting these problems because otherwise the user will have a bad experience or will not understand the error, or it will make their code not compile anymore, stuff like that. So there's definitely a thing, a limit for when something is too nitpicky and when it's useful, but then you still need to explain it carefully so that people don't get frustrated and they actually understand it.
Right, right. Yeah, because if you use the Phantom Builder pattern to do too much handholding, it can start to feel nitpicky. So you, at the same time, it is freeing for the user to have certain scenarios that they don't have to think about because they're impossible. And so, as with any of these API design considerations, you need to really weigh the trade-offs.
Yeah. In this case, it's kind of like handholding when you're trying to cross the road and forbidding you to cross the road when there's a car in the next mile around you.
Like,
right. That's going to make sure that you don't die, but it's a bit overly protective.
Right.
And yeah. So what is overly protective? What isn't? That's the question. Like the for the Elm compiler or the Elm language, you have no shadowing, and that annoys a lot of people, and they think it's not warranted or it's not necessary. And I can see the point. I'm personally convinced otherwise, but it's something that if you want to get across well, you need to explain well, which I think is done correctly, but. It's still something that people need to be convinced of.
Yeah.
There's also something that we didn't mention before, I think. It's like the tool just needs to do the job that it advertises well.
Yes.
So, like, for instance, if you promise that you're going to build an Elm project, if you're going to create an Elm Pages application, well, you need to do it correctly, right? You should not crash at all. You should not give bad error messages when things do go wrong. Yeah, and that's a lot of work. There's no magic. There's just trying out the thing, finding edge cases yourself, and when things go wrong, either present a nice error message with all the context that you want to provide to the user, or fix the issue. That's a lot of work for tooling authors, in my opinion. But
it is.
But in practice, it's worth it for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's obviously huge for trust, making tools that are, in fact, dependable or packages. And I think another thing that really helps there is just, I mean, having a small and focused tool or API, having a smaller API surface area, there's just less that can go wrong, less edge cases for you to think about and for the user to think about, less mental model to create. It's just like, so if you can find simpler ways to express things, you can create less work for yourself.
Now I'm wondering whether I'm doing too much with ElmReview, but
I don't think so. But
you have not seen my plans, Dylan.
I don't want to stop you. It sounds enticing. I think back sometimes to I wonder if our sense of creating reliable software has degraded at all. I don't know if that's something that every generation thinks that things are deteriorating, right? But I think about like the term software engineering. I just recently learned was created by Margaret Hamilton, who was working on the Apollo program. And
okay, didn't know that.
The robustness of the systems they had on the Apollo missions were pretty remarkable. And I mean, even like, so when they did the Apollo 11 moon landing, there were some program alarms going off, you know, and because they were putting the systems under some strain that it hadn't been under before, but the amount of drilling they did prepared them for these different scenarios. And they had like basically they take these, you know, lunar module simulators and do all these training scenarios and try to create these edge cases where they have to choose whether to abort the mission or how to handle it and all this stuff. And man, it's impressive the amount of consideration that goes into designing these systems. So Margaret Hamilton created this term to capture the amount of care that goes into building this software that is really like an engineering discipline in the sense of we need to build robust systems. It's not just willing. And I mean, really, it's incredible that there were these program alarms, 1201, 1202 program alarms going off in the Apollo landing that they had never encountered before in the simulations, but the code worked. The code, you know, the program alarms were saying that they were having to shove off non-essential tasks from the processor because they had very limited processor power, but it worked. Those code paths completely worked. That's how robust it was. So I don't know what we have to learn from that other than, I mean,
we stand on the shoulder of giants.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for, you know, what do they call it? The, you know, that doctor's oath to do no harm, the Hippocratic.
First, never harm.
Oath. Yeah. And I think it's first do no harm, like an Asimov rule for robots. Or is that doctors? I don't know.
No, first do no harm. I think it's the Socratic oath.
That's part of the Hippocratic oath? Okay.
Yeah, I'm not a doctor.
Yeah. But we need something like that for engineering. And I feel like Elm does equip us with tools for carefully considering use cases. I'm not talking about upfront design here, but I'm talking about really examining holistically the experience you're giving to users, the things that can go wrong when somebody uses your tool, whether it's an end user, a developer, internal colleagues, whatever it might be.
I feel like the O should start with something like, first, do not seek escape hatches.
Oh, wow. You might be onto something here.
Yeah, because that actually like requires you, oh, well, I need to understand the thing. I need to read documentation. I need to dig in or something. Yeah, that's use the tool for what it was purposed for.
Create not superstitions in your user's yeah. mind.
And then hackers might think like, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly does feel like, I mean, when you look at Lambda, Evergreen migrations and things like this, like it does feel like a different way of thinking about problem solving where you can really think about, am I handling every case in a way that is harder to do in other contexts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The fact, for instance, that Elm requires you to handle all the error cases is really nice to make tools, right? Because all that remains is to make it nice, to give the user a nice error message, basically.
Right.
As long as you're in Elm world.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, user experience and developer experience are kind of one and the same. Like you want to give users a good, predictable, robust experience.
Yep. I mean, I see developer experience as the same. It's just like my users are developers, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they're serving other users and you want to help them serve those users better.
Which in turn might also be serving users.
That's true. It's users all the way down.
Yeah. And maybe somewhere at the bottom, there's a developer. And then it's a circle or a cycle or a graph.
Infinite loop? Uh-oh.
Directed graph. It's a complex system we live in, Dylan.
It certainly is.
There's another case which I'm thinking of, and that is when the tool is doing something without telling you or without giving you the information. So the example that I have is, for instance, automatic fixes that the linter gave you. So if you look at ESLint, ESLint has a fix mode. So you do ESLint dash dash fix, and that's going to run all the rules and it's going to apply all the automatic fixes that it finds. and then it's going to save that to the file system. And the problem with that is that at the end, you don't see what has happened. You don't know what has changed. The only thing you're left is the files on your system and maybe a Git diff if you have Git, which you should. You look at the diff and you're like, well, I don't know why this thing changed. Like, and you're missing some information, like which rules were triggered. How did they change my code? Is that change safe? Is it something that I should worry about? Is it going to change how it behaves? Maybe for the better, but is it going to change how it behaves? And what is the reasoning for the errors that occurred and the reason for this change? Like, yeah, a lot of information that you have to basically dig for. Mm-hmm. If the only thing you have is a diff, that I've always found to be a bit of a problem. And that's why in ElmReview, every time when you run it in fixed mode, every time you encounter an error, you have a prompt where you see all the error messages and details, and you can say okay or not to this suggested fix, which you can have a preview for. And like, yeah, if you don't have that information, it's going to be very hard to trust the tool, right?
Yeah, the high stakes situations like that are a very fast way to lose trust.
What do you mean with high stakes?
Like if you do a money transaction where a user has money where it's not clear that money is being spent, you will quickly lose trust. If you overwrite users' files when they're not clear that they're doing a destructive transaction that is going to potentially change or remove files, you will quickly lose their trust.
Yeah.
So those high stakes scenarios, you have to be very careful about communicating the intent and letting the user know what's going on and opt into it.
Kind of feels like filing your taxes to me.
Mm.
Like you have a bunch of numbers and at the end you have this amount to pay and like, well, I don't know how these all fit together, but that's the way it is. So yeah. Just like with ESIN or with taxes, either you accept it as it is, like, okay, I guess it's right, or you're going to complain and call the support center or whatever, and then you might learn that they were actually correct the entire time. Mm-hmm. But yes, if you don't understand what is going on, like it's not helpful for you. And as a maintainer, you're going to have a lot of complaints as well. Like, hey, this is not doing what I wanted. And yeah.
And once you lose that trust, people will never fully trust a tool or a product, you know?
It's going to take at least a few months, depending on your tool and how often people use it. But yeah, it's going to take a while for people to know, okay, well, it's really been a long time since I've had this problem occur.
Yeah, you'll need a rebrand. You'll have to change company names, change your tool's name, put up a sign that says under new management.
I think in Elm 0.19.0, there were cases where the competitor didn't check some things and you had to remove the Elm stuff. It's been a while.
Well, and there were like the map crashes and things like that. Yeah.
Also, yeah. So those were annoying, but the fact that it didn't do the proper checks when you needed it was annoying.
Yeah. You know, just like with, you know, we've talked about the difference between 99% guarantees and 100% guarantees and how different that experience feels working with abstractions that give you those full guarantees. And similarly, like the difference between 99% trust and 100% trust. I mean, obviously we don't 100% trust anything really, but you know what I mean? Like once you lose a little bit of faith in a tool and start to second guess it, you no longer trust it. You like if you lose trust, you know, it, like if you fully can depend on a tool, it's a totally different experience. And again, like if you have a more transparent abstractions that build an opinionated layer building off of an existing layer with some light abstractions with strong opinions. That's one way that helps you do that, having like a focused small tool.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be more ambitious, then it's harder to to earn that trust. And it's harder to prove to users that your tool is trustworthy.
Yeah. Or you might be trustworthy in one feature, but mm-hmm. not trustworthy in a new feature that you're developing.
Right.
Kind of like that. There's a bias of where if you know that someone is good at something, is an expert at something, then you're going to assume that they're going to be experts at something else as well, which will often not be the case. Like if I'm starting to make videos about knitting,
yeah,
then if you only know me from Elm, like, oh, he's good at Elm, he must be good at knitting. No, I'm not. That has a name, but I don't remember what it is. If I find it, I will add it to the show notes.
Yeah. So, okay, Jeroen, let's take a stab at a Hippocratic oath for tooling developers. Okay, so
tooling developers, not developers.
For developers.
Okay, then I would like to start with, first, do not seek escape hatches.
Okay, yes. Be dependable and let the user know that you're dependable through feedback.
I like that.
Don't leave the user confused.
Wait, did you already prepare this?
I am looking at some...
No, you're cheating.
Like, don't.
I don't have anything to offer here.
Don't make them refresh.
Don't make them refresh, yeah.
Eliminate caveats.
We already have... Oh, no, yeah, caveats, yeah. Mm-hmm. Make sure your tool doesn't crash. Something yep. like that.
Give a clear mental model.
Tell the user what you're going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, let the user opt in.
Also, yeah. Don't organize surprise parties.
Don't offer invalid ways to configure or use your tool.
Mm-hmm. And then I think we should end with saying use Elm.
Elm adoption is going to skyrocket after this tweet goes viral about our Hippocratic oath for developers. That's pretty good. I think that's definitely a tweet. If not a tweet, then a screenshot of some text that we can tweet.
In multiple tweets.
A tweet thread.
One image with one of those lines per tweet. That's how you
with
make,
like relaxing background images. Well, if we've missed anything for our Hippocratic developer oath, then tweet it at us, reply to our tweet, let us know, and you're in. Until next time.
Until next time.